Okay, I think we're live with everybody. It's great to be with you. Alexandra, are you there?
Yes.
Fantastic. We have Forbidden Knowledge TV's Alexandra Bruce with us. And we're going to do something special. We're going to go into some of these.
Alexandra, are you there?
Oh, there we
Yes.
go. Fantastic. We
Well,
have
that's
Forbidden Knowledge
good.
TV's Alexandra. That's good that the echo works.
Wow, there's such a delay.
Isn't that fascinating?
I always like that on Google.
It must be to bleep out all the swear words that we
Yeah. Wow.
use. It's great to see you, and it's great to be here with everyone. It's interesting. We're coming into this episode, and we're talking about deep state witnesses that disappear. Now, when we've been going through the JFK files, of course, there was an actuary who was hired to, and this was in 1970, to figure out if all those witnesses who either talked to the Warren Commission or had a different version of events, and how they were slowly bumped off one at a time, including the railway guy, Lee Bowers, who saw the view from behind the picket fence where most of the shots came from. So they hired an actuary to figure out the odds, and the odds came out, and this was in the movie Executive Action, which came out in the early 70s. The odds were 100,000 trillion to one. So that got me thinking about the witnesses, and of course, in investigating these deep state cases, you always find this, the witnesses and this pattern of the witnesses being bumped off. And certainly in the case of the Las Vegas shooting, we've had a lot of those witnesses recently just disappear. And it's quite a theme, but I want to take us back into this period of looking at this. By the way, for everyone who tuned in to the HBO special that I was in for the JFK assassination files release, and we discussed the UFO enigma and some of the secrecy around that. It was fantastic. The numbers from that were great. I've been getting numbers over 2 million views on that, and excuse me, the even the Facebook link on that had a quarter of a million views. So just fantastic, and I appreciate everyone's support on that. And I have to say, I really appreciate the HBO Vice News team because the Vice News Tonight people did a very professional job on it. And I think that they kind of went outside their comfort zone to do it also. And so that's a very good sign for things to come with them. Now, one of the things I will say about doing that is that it's raised all of these questions in different quarters about what was going on with the JFK assassination in terms of the UFO secrecy aspect. So tomorrow I will be putting up my interview that I just did with former Watergate attorney Douglas Caddy. And we did a controversial interview in 2015 where he spoke about how E. Howard Hunt, his friend who was the CIA super spy, had told him that it was the alien presence that JFK was assassinated over because he wanted to share that secret. It's pretty heavy, and this was not some kind of CIA smokescreen. They were good friends talking in private conversation before Hunt went off to prison for his role in the Watergate crimes and the break-in there. So it's, I think it's one of those pieces that is absolutely crucial if you want to understand things like these deep state assassinations, like UFO secrecy, even the secret space program, because you're really getting in there to the hardcore inside discussion about it. And of course, Caddy knew nothing at the time about UFOs, but I'll save all of my conversation with him, which has it's just packed with revelations, and I'm very excited about it. But that will run, well, that's going to run this week, and that's something that I think everyone can look forward to. And that's kind of like one of those things when I speak to Caddy, I'm getting that impression. You know, we did the Coast to Coast AM special last week about him and his revelations, and he came on and spoke about it. And you just get that impression of this little kind of valuable piece of information that's out there. And I remember when I first did the interview, we did a 3-hour interview, which is available here on the Dark Journalist channel. And what's fascinating about it is that thing was blasted all over newspapers and everything else in Europe. And it got over 100,000 video views and all the rest of it. But the newspapers, the media, you know, even the fact that he was a Watergate lawyer and had this standing, and they could have just sort of taken it as a novelty. They so had a blackout on him and what he was talking about that I became even more convinced that it's something that we have to dig deeper on. And I think
tell us, like, recap what he said exactly.
Well, I did actually a little bit there. I was talking about how Hunt was his good friend, and that before he went off to prison, he told Caddy that JFK was assassinated because of the alien presence and the fact that he was going to give that secret away. It actually ties a lot of bits and pieces in history up together. And I'm feeling like this is a very crucial piece that we need to get. You know, Caddy is now 80, and he just wrote his autobiography, which is coming out in January. But Caddy had been very under the radar, and this conversation took place in 1975. So let's think about that. You know, that's over 40 years ago now. And I think when we look back on it, for these two friends to be discussing this, and for this real insider to mention that the assassination was over the alien presence, is absolutely crucial. And of course, we brought that up in the HBO special. And it seems to me that this is a real crucial area of investigation to look into, because that UFO file and the sensitivity around it, if anyone, including the president, wants to share that with our counterparts, in this case, the Soviet Union at the time, just like if Trump wanted to do it with Russia today, that deep state secrecy group would just hop to it and, you know, eliminate him. And this is what happened in the case of Kennedy. But I think the Caddy revelation is bigger than, you know, all the accumulated information around it suggests it. But Caddy's revelation that Hunt said it, and no context, no, you know, it wasn't in the air. People weren't talking about this issue in 1975. They were talking about the assassination, maybe, but certainly not the UFO secrecy being associated with it. That's something that came up years later. So I think it's fascinating, and I'm starting to thread that needle, as we started to suggest in the special, that the Garrison investigation and the fact that they held those files back in the recent, and they have a number of files, because of course, it's confirmed that the CIA was interfering with the Garrison investigation. And that brings us into this whole area of Garrison's witnesses who were knocked off, either bought off or bumped off one by one. So we'll go through some of these. And I think that we should bring it all the way up to date through some of these. But you're familiar with this case of William Bruce Pitzer?
Yeah, well, I just saw this. It's part of this series, the six-part series or multiple-part series about the men who killed Kennedy. And it's quite interesting how it this man who was sent to kill him, he was being trained as an assassin for the CIA, and he describes how he was asked to kill this Pitzer guy, and it would have been here in the United States, and he understood that domestic assassinations like this were to be carried out by the mafia. It would be illegal. It's illegal to assassinate under American, you know, U.S. law.
Yeah.
So, you know, he found that odd, and then he backed out of it. And then years later, he saw that it actually had gone through, and he thought that by coming forward to sort of discuss these methods and this his story, that it might prevent this from happening again. I mean, as if it would, he needed to get it off his chest. So it's actually quite moving. I had run this series years ago, and I didn't remember this particular part. It's fascinating.
It is very interesting. That's Dangerous Dan Marvin. And Dan Marvin was a Vietnam hero. He was a Green Beret. He had done all these incredible ops as part of his work. And part of the training that they got that he talked about was from these CIA instructors. And at one point in this discussion, he said one of the CIA instructors said, things really did go well in Dealey Plaza. Which was very haunting kind of comment. But they also said to him and the group that was assembled there to learn these special forces methods that Oswald wasn't involved in the shooting at all. He was the patsy, which I found very interesting that they would share that information. But it was one of these CIA trainers that came to him and made this odd suggestion about assassinating William Bruce Pitzer. And Pitzer's very fascinating because he ran, he was an admiral, and he ran the audiovisual side of the whole Navy station. And he had access to the autopsy videos of President Kennedy. And when he announced he was going to retire, that's when apparently they decided we need to tie up a loose end there just in case he has some of these films around or if he gets hired by some television station or something. They just didn't trust him. And there's always been unusual circumstances around his death. And I think the fact that Marvin, when he's watching this special years later and he sees the name come up, William Bruce Pitzer, and Pitzer's such an unusual name that it stuck with him. And then he remembered that conversation and that they had accomplished this assassination. So we see this pattern when the deep state gets into it and they realize somebody's out there with a piece of information that's going to mess up the official story, they send out one of these assassination teams. I think that this is important, and we have to kind of explore it deeply to understand how it works now so that we don't get confused when a case like Las Vegas comes up and we just found out that one of the main witnesses in that case was killed in a hit and run, but seven of the major witnesses have died now in a very short window of time. And you can't always say when something happens around these events, well, that's the deep state involved. Sometimes things just happen. It's true. But I think when we see a pattern like this with so many questions, we can hearken back to people who did the investigations, like people like Garrison or Mark Lane, who were looking at the JFK case, which had so many. Like I said, the odds were 100,000 trillion to one that those people would have died in such a short space of time.
I'd like somebody to calculate that for the people who've died, the survivors who've died, and witnesses who've died. The porter who checked in Stephen Paddock's luggage and said he was a normal guy and he didn't have a lot of stuff, and he ended up shot to death in front of his church. And then another guy also was shot like a block from his church where he'd just been. So what's up with these churches?
It is. It's very unusual. And we know there was that strange shoot 'em up at a church in Texas right around there too. There's definitely a wave of that. It's interesting that you mentioned this about the porter, though, because we've seen a number of cases where people come forward to say something about that and they get bumped off because there's such a secondary dialogue going on around this Las Vegas case, which is the people who were on the ground, many of them saw and heard things that were different. And even the official story has changed now a couple of times in a very short window. And I mean, when you see that kind of reaction, you know, with the way that you do your own journalism, that there's something very strange about the Las Vegas case.
Oh, very strange. I think that there's probably chicanery and lies upon lies. I mean, we know that the official story can't be true. It doesn't make any sense. It's been changed. Now they won't even answer questions. They've given up trying to lie about it, whatever it is. Somebody who used to work for me contacted me for the first time in 2 years, and he's been working at a lobbying group in D.C., and he has a friend who works at the Department of Defense. He says, I can tell you who did what the deal is with Las Vegas. He said, I have a friend at the DOD who told me that Stephen Paddock was major Antifa, and that the government really doesn't want to disclose that, because it would be a bad look for Antifa, because in general, you'll see that the mainstream media supports them.
Yeah.
But also, that I guess it would cause a real kind of civil war type of reaction between left and right in the United States. So they just want to keep it quiet that Stephen Paddock was totally Antifa and that he was shooting country music attendees because he figured that they're right wing. Mm-hmm. And I just said, well, your friend's lying to you, because there were multiple shooters and Stephen Paddock did not do Las Vegas.
All right.
And uh-huh. he's a bro. Like, he's a solid bro. He would never lie to me. And I said, well, then the DOD's lying to him. but it's hard to tell. You know, what's really going on there. I really don't think Stephen Paddock did the Las Vegas shooting. I mean, they just came out with another story yesterday that, you know, 1,100 rounds were fired by Stephen Paddock. I don't buy it.
Let's balance this out a little bit, because we have on one hand, and this gets into dark journalism. In dark journalism, the way that I've laid it out, there's three levels. There's the official story, there's the counter story, the secondary story right. that pops up, and that's usually people looking into it. Sometimes you get a lot of authors, researchers, professors. Now you get a lot of independent journalists or people who are on Reddit, you know, investigating it and coming up with details that are valuable. That's often called the conspiracy theory when we get into this genre, when we get into this world through the media, because they don't want anyone to go there. And then this thing comes up and it's a junk conspiracy. I call it third force narratives, because it's this third force against the counter thing and the official story. And when that swoops in, it muddies up the water so badly that everyone who is looking into the secondary case says, oh, forget it. You know, I'm going to go back to the original story because the junk conspiracy is so crazy. I have to run away from this type of reporting or these types of people, whatever it is. Now, interestingly enough, the JFK case has a classic one, which is the driver did it, which is ridiculous. The driver didn't do anything except maybe stop in Dealey Plaza, which is very strange. But there's this whole thing about, hey, the driver did it. He turned around and shot him in the car. Well, everyone would know if that happened. And in the film itself, you can see that didn't happen. And no one's ever, who was there, there's no witness who ever said that. So this was one of those junk conspiracies that got thrown up and mixed in with real research around the idea that the shots came from the front, for example, which is totally the trail of evidence will lead you to that suggestion. But if I'm to get you off of that suggestion, I need to take you into this other world and say, well, you know, you have this thing floating around YouTube now. It's like Jackie did it or something, you know?
Oh yeah, I've seen it. It's very convincing. I think they just do a little altering to the frames and it looks like she just brings his head in and goes.
Yes. Isn't it like, but don't we have to get really smart in alternative media, because that's the way to manipulate a scene. Now, there's different ways that junk conspiracy comes in. Junk conspiracy can come in through just an opportunist marketing thing that says, let's get a lot of clicks on this or whatever. Sometimes it's organic like that, but it's so easy to pull a psyop around it, flood the internet with a silly thing, and people are like, oh, I can't look at the conspiracy part of it. People who are saying that, you know, I wanted to look into it, but there's all this junk around it. I guess we'll stick with the official story. And I think that's the goal here. So getting through it, that's what I call dark journalism. It's not conspiracy theory. It's getting in deeper in that. And I think that's what we're doing here. But here's what's fascinating about all that. So when you see something come up, we know that people died, for example, in this Las Vegas shooting, and there's families that are mourning this whole thing. And then when we go back and we look at some of these cases all the way from the 60s, where witnesses disappear, you know, these are people being taken out of other people's lives and all the rest of it. So we have to have a kind of sensitivity when we're in the media and use evidence-based trails, as opposed to just saying, oh, it was all a hoax, or that shooting didn't happen, or everybody was a crisis actor. You know, I mean, the crisis actor thing is very important. It's an aspect that we need to look at, but we can't have a knee-jerk reaction every 5 minutes and say that somebody's a crisis actor when they're not.
Right. Well, yeah, this is the clickbaity nature of the platform, you know, of the whole, of the medium.
Yes.
It's really dangerous to...
It is.
To good information and to good communication, unfortunately.
Well, yeah. It slices and dices any kind of journalistic standards that you would bring in.
Yeah.
And I think it's important. This is the thing. The alternative, the independent media, is important because it can go outside of the official story, which is controlled by all of these forces, corporate forces, political forces, deep state forces. They know at what edge, where to stop the information flow, where the choke point is. So in alternative media, we get to go beyond that. That's why the alternative media is valuable. But if they throw in the junk conspiracy, and some of these very deep state forces will probably do that, around the UFO topic, for example, you know, this incredible research for 70 years on UFOs. It's absolutely a reality. It's ridiculous that the media doesn't take it seriously. It's absurd.
Yeah, well, and then Little Green Men is the constant, or, you know, it's still there. I mean, people still say it. I was just in a room the other day when the guy said Little Green Men about the whole possibility that that other life exists. That's the response that it drew.
Mm-hmm.
Other self-aware, sentient life.
It's absolutely fascinating. I mean, there's so much good research around it.
Mm-hmm.
Take Mac, take Stanton Friedman. You know, there's really solid data. Linda Moulton Howe. Years and years of research. So to try to go back and take us all into the dark ages on it is absurd. Now, one of the things that they're doing is they've got this whole flat earth meme pushed to the max. Now, the mainstream media, for some reason, is covering this guy who has a rocket, supposedly, and he wants to fly around the world to prove that it's flat. It's so stupid, but it is meant to, and now we're getting back into that fake news thing, right? It's meant to make the alternative media connected with this thing. And if you can do that,
it's to me, I think it was concocted. I think that this is a psychological operation.
Yes.
And that it's very well done. I mean, I've even heard the arguments, and it's very convincing, but it just doesn't make any sense in the context of everything else that we know about, you know, the other planets. Like, why would the Earth be flat and all the other planets not?
Yes. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Like, you just buy the flat earth or a telescope and the game's over.
Yeah.
But I do think it's interesting because it's one of those things that's meant to split up the alternative view. It's meant to split up the independent factor. And we have to keep an eye on those things because they pop up around these subjects all the time. So when we talk about Las Vegas, you're talking about genuine anomalies that are going on there in that case. When I speak about the JFK assassination and the witnesses, you know, we could talk here all night about the witnesses that were eliminated, and we're going to talk about some of the more interesting cases on that tonight. But literally, we could do a 6-hour show on it and have more material because there's a factual basis. And this gets us back to what is the meaning? What is the truth when you're coming forward with a story? You have to apply these journalistic standards, or you get into this morass of anything goes and you become the plaything for intel psyops or marketing games. And that's a very tricky place. And I think in your work and in my work, we've seen we're surrounded by that when we're trying to get to the truth.
Right. That's like you're saying, the knee-jerk thing to say that everything was is a crisis acting fake. You know, I think that maybe in the case in Los Angeles, there might be aspects to it that are that. There are maybe, I don't know. The stuff that I'm looking at, it seems like there were multiple shooters and that it was like a bona fide terror attack.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, you have an incredible track record with the work that you put up of avoiding junk conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
You cast a very wide net and go so far beyond the mainstream that the mainstream would call you conspiracy theory, right? But the junk conspiracy is this kind of level that you don't allow into your work. And that's fascinating. That's the same thing for me. I often call that stuff out. But I think it's important to separate what real anomalies are, you know, what the real story is. For me, it's a counter-narrative to the official story because there's such a difference between the reality on the ground, say in a case like UFOs, and what we're looking at with some of these things around the mainstream media, you know, that official story versus the facts on the ground. We know different. We know better.
Right.
So you can't.
It's a culture of killing witnesses that is, it's very present in sort of American politics. I mean, you have the Clinton body count is another example.
Mm-hmm.
And very significantly, Donna Brazile dedicating her book to Seth Rich, I think is incredible. It's great that she did that.
And go through Seth Rich again. This was a very powerful story during the election. But
yeah. Seth Rich is okay. He worked for the DNC and he was helping with voter outreach programs. He worked in the IT department. And he had access to all of the voter information, you know, how the DNC was getting votes and trying to get out the vote. And that's what he was working on improving. And it is suspected, there's a lot of evidence to support, that he became disgruntled when he saw that Hillary had stolen the election from Bernie, because he was a Bernie supporter. And that as a result of disgruntled, he went to WikiLeaks, and he was the source of Hillary's and the DNC's leaks that were made to WikiLeaks.
Fascinating. You know, there is a story from Watergate. There was an editor, a writer named Jack Anderson, and he was doing all these stories about how the CIA had hired the mafia for various hit jobs. And it came up in conversation at the White House that Gordon Liddy said that Hunt, this discussion came up where, and I found this fascinating, where they were talking about sanctioning Anderson, basically getting rid of him. And, you know, as it turned out, that never happened. And it might have been just a flight of fancy. But I did find that interesting, that when these journalists get too close to the truth, and we saw you did a lot of incredible coverage on Michael Hastings in this regard, and it was a very unusual case. But, you know, the story that he brought forward embarrassed the, you know, the command that we had over there in Afghanistan. And one of the major generals lost his job, actually, over it.
Right.
So he was working on a drug story. That was the next piece of what he was doing. And then all those strange anomalies show up where Hastings dies and his motor is like a half mile behind him. It just doesn't make
The people who lived on that block reported an explosion that shook the foundations of their homes. And I've seen photos of that block. I've seen footage of that block. And those are big, you know, cement structures. And the motor of his car was, I don't know, 60 or more feet away from the car. And it was impaled on a tree, but the cars don't burst into flame,
right,
when they're going, you know, whatever, 50, 60 miles an hour or whatever that he was. It wasn't that fast.
It's absolutely, I mean, and there was a big chill when Obama was in office against journalism. What's fascinating also is that, you know, they've made all this case about Trump being really bad for the media, but really it's his fight with CNN or MSNBC. You know, I mean, that's what I really see about him. And the real chill came during the Obama administration. Cheryl Atkinson did that book Stonewalled about the number of things that they did to her, like invading her laptop and searching for information and really harassing her. That was going on under Obama. I mean, so let's get real about, you know, how this is just done when a certain political party feels like they're taking the heat for something like Benghazi or something else.
Yeah, I think that this is now where we get into mind control and manipulation, like what's going on with, like if you look at, I mean, it's not only that guy, Jim Acosta at CNN and whoever at MSNBC. It's pretty widespread in the mainstream media. And Stephen Colbert, I think, is the man. I mean, if you look at his the YouTube page for his comedy show, it's Trump is in the headline of every single video posted.
That's, you know, it's absurd. And the whole, like, embedding a narrative inside of comedy that's going on through this, and how they really tried to basically crown Hillary with this late night comedy routines. I mean, you know, comedy, you can always have political comedy, but it shouldn't be the arm. I mean, they're obviously funding these people, which I find.
It really looks to me, for all the world, that Stephen Colbert is getting paid to do what he's doing.
Right.
I mean, he might agree with it, but yeah, it's just, how could you make that the only focus of your comedy every night?
It is.
Are we really to believe that you're sad that Hillary didn't win? I mean, is that what we really want? I thank goodness Susan Sarandon came out and said we would have been screwed if she was elected. We'd be at war and things would be. It's true.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, I think there's a lot to be said for that, which is, that's a kind of subtle hypnosis. And, you know, I hate to see so much hypnosis in the culture. You know, you'd like to just get by with it and say like, well, this guy has his opinion or whatever. But it's such a program that you can't even avoid it if you want to. So right. I think that that's really what we're seeing. Two of the main cases that would be deep state witnesses who were journalists would be Gary Webb and Danny Casolaro. And in Webb's case, you know, the Contra story about the Contras bringing in drugs to this country and the CIA supplying drugs and that whole crack epidemic and all that. I mean, it's an explosive story. And that's why his book, Dark Alliance, is such a classic, because it really brought that whole thing to the surface. And when I spoke to Fitz about it, Catherine Austin Fitz, who was in the government, as we know, as Assistant Secretary of HUD under Bush 1 and worked in HUD for Clinton, she said that there are certain phrases in that book that let you know that he really understood what he was talking about. Because when you're in government, you see all these books come out about the CIA or drugs or secret money or whatever it is, and you know that they're really just full of it because they don't use these certain phrases and processes. Well, in Webb's book, she found those processes and she was like, what is going on here? And we know that Webb's life, they even did a movie, Kill the Messenger. They didn't really get into the hardcore details on that. I think they missed a lot. Just like the recent movie about Barry Seal that Tom Cruise did, probably the reason it bombed is because you didn't talk about his connection to the CIA, which is that's the whole point of the story. No. So, you know, I mean, you're not going to miss that. Just make him into a good old boy who liked to fly back and forth, you know. You're missing too much. But I do think it's interesting because, you know, we have these figures, like Webb was forced to the fringes of society. Actually, at the end of his life, he was doing classified ads for some newspaper, like, you know, that was really out in the boonies. And then he turned up in a very unusual suicide case, I think.
Two shots to the head.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you pull that off. But in any case, whether he was forced into this kind of suicidal thinking because they had destroyed his life, you know, there was an actual hit team on, they were called and this is something I spoke about with Professor Peter Dale Scott, but they were called the Get Webb team on the LA Times. And even later they were like, yeah, we went too far to get that guy. You know, so this is the kind of media climate that he was dealing with, bringing these subjects to the surface. So we see there is an apparatus there, and we have to be very careful and very logical about what that apparatus is. You know, and then, of course, in alternative media, you see sometimes everyone, you know, if they have a flat tire, they're like, the deep state is after me. That's not how it works. right.
But I know who you're talking about.
I won't name any names, but geez, you know, we have to move on from that. And I think we also have to take it more seriously because journalists, especially on the independent side, you know, when they're in these situations, and I have a whole thing about a New Zealand journalist that I'll send to you, which I think is fascinating. I had some correspondence with her, and she's really under attack for the stories she's been running, and they've been trying to kind of intimidate her in different ways. There's so many serious stories. I guess that's what I'm trying to get to when it comes to the UFO question, when it comes to JFK, when it comes to the Las Vegas thing, that the frill stuff, you know, I don't want to know about John McCain's leg brace, but there's too many important topics for us to go into. And frankly, you know, that kind of stuff becomes distraction that serves the deep state. And I'd like to see the independent media rise to the occasion on things like that. You know, it's hard to expect it because it's so many different people and it's not like it's a regulated environment. But certainly, I think as viewers of that kind of stuff, we can demand higher standards.
Yeah, as I said, there is a flaw to the whole medium itself, you know, this clickbaity.
Yes.
Thing. Really, I think it's we as a culture, you know, need to evolve to not be baited by clickbait. You
know? Well, we need to encourage the people who are doing the good stuff, like the work that you're doing, for example, at ForbiddenKnowledgeTV.net, Solari.com. Catherine Austin Fitz site, a lot of news there. You know, you can subscribe, but a lot of it's free. So There's that. Joseph Farrell's Giza Death Star. He does his own blogs. You know, Cryptogon, fantastic information. Great stuff. So, you know, we have to wonder when these things come up. You know, I don't want someone to send me something about John McCain's leg brace. You know, I have real things to do. So this is the way it works, you know. And so let's get into one of these, though, because I think it's fascinating. We've been talking about the JFK 2017. Is there anything else you wanted to add to the media part, by the way?
I don't think I got to finish what happened to Seth Rich was, you know, that he's very, there seems to be many indications that he was the source of the WikiLeaks DNC leak and Hillary emails, I think.
Right.
But or at least, if nothing else, just the DNC leaks, absolutely. But he was murdered, and his murder has just simply languished and not really been investigated. You know, they're saying that he was the victim of an attempted robbery, but he had many expensive items on his person that were not stolen. So it just doesn't make sense, and they're just not, they don't care about finding out the truth. There also was a very interesting Reddit claiming to be a nurse who was in attendance there. And he said that basically all the nurses were asked to leave, and he was basically, Seth Rich was allowed to bleed out and die.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating. I'll tell you, there's a lot of strangeness around the case. I will say this, that I find it unusual, and I think that probably Brazil must know something to dedicate the book to him, or at least must know those methods around the Clinton machine. It's disturbing. That whole story was very disturbing, but it did drive the election. It's almost like, you know, people started to understand it. At a certain point, even Hannity raised it on Fox News, and he got a whirlwind of blowback for doing that.
Oh, gosh. And Rod Wheeler, who was the former FBI, a former DC guy who had sources that were, you know, telling him that he... Talking about Donna Brazile, actually, he has disappeared. He has absolutely clammed up and disappeared. I suspect that he's either been threatened or paid. He's completely up in a puff of smoke. He was a correspondent on Fox News. He was fired.
Wow.
For the Seth Rich thing. The Seth Rich thing is so toxic. That's why Donna Brazile dedicating her book to him was very significant.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you've written 6 books, right? Mm-hmm. 6? So when you dedicate a book,
it's a big deal. The first one was to my grandmother, I think. The second one was to my mother. The third one was to my dad. It's like that, you know?
Absolutely.
It's like people who are the most important people to you, basically.
No question. So when somebody of that level, you know, who was really running the DNC at the end after Wasserman Schultz stepped down, and the Wasserman Schultz thing was very fascinating because I felt like the Clintons were setting her up as the straw man for the entire thing. So they could say, if this thing goes south, blame it all on this woman who really was, you know, social climbing and like getting her game on as the DNC head. But I felt out of the blue, I almost felt like the Clintons were helping along this pile on Schultz. It was very unusual. But we get that. I mean, there's so many strange forces around that whole election in 2016. I think we were really talking about ground zero in terms of a deep state election because it was really a hardcore battle right up till the end. Now, one thing you mentioned there that made me think was, did this guy Braverman ever show up again?
Braverman, I'm sorry. Who's Braverman?
Well, there was a guy who was associated with the Clinton campaign, and he sort of took off to Jamaica, and then nobody could get in touch with him. And you ran some videos on it, but it might be a while since we had an update on that. So if it doesn't ring a bell, we'll just be...
Yeah, no, it's been over a year, I guess. And I kind of remember the name, but I have another person named Braverman, a few other people named Braverman. They're all these big personality guys, so I'm confused. Like, who was he again? Was he in the DNC? I'm forgetting. God, I'm going senile. I don't know what's happened to me.
Oh, you're sharper than anybody. I do want to remind our viewers that when we are exploring this Kennedy wave, that you actually had a personal connection there and that JFK Jr. was a friend of yours.
Yes, I went to college with him. And he dated my older sister, and He also dated my friend's older sister. So yeah, I've known him since I was
a dating guy. Let's face it.
Yeah.
You but there have been stories that came out after the fact that he was not very satisfied around the story of his dad's assassination, that he knew there was something deeper, and that part of starting this magazine, George, which looked into political aspects that were going on, was about that. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, well, it's, and I absolutely, like many people, and it would happen to be his father, he was unsatisfied with the official explanation. And that he ended up dead under strange circumstances. I happened to be not too far from him. I was in Montauk, New York, outside. I was working outside that evening, and people talk about the haze and things like this. It was a very clear night. It was not hazy.
Mm. Oh, there's so many anomalies around his death that I think it's very strange. We could probably do a show just on that. But I think there's a lot of reasons for it, because I don't think he was satisfied with it. And I also think that he himself was going to try to run for higher office. Does that sound wild to you, having the fact that you knew him? Do you think he would have ever kind of run for
office? Well, when I knew him at college, when he was in his early 20s,
he
didn't want to run for anything. People were always asking him.
I'm sure. Yeah.
But at that point, I guess he was in his late 30s. And he might have. I don't think George is really doing very well financially, and maybe he would have moved on to his inexorable fate, which was to run for something. And of course, the person who ended up getting that seat was Hillary Clinton. Don't forget.
It is. It was her springboard. And
she never lived in New York her whole life. Like, how she got that seat, I'll never know.
It would have been, that would have been a major block if he had run. And it is interesting that it was the year before, because it was 1999 and the election.
It's for 2000.
2000, yeah. It's so unusual. It really is. But let's track this back a little bit, because now Robert Kennedy Jr. came out, was talking to Charlie Rose, and he said that his dad, Robert Kennedy, didn't think anything of the Warren Commission. He thought it was shoddy work, and he knew that the outcome was totally different. Now, we know this. There was a wonderful book by David Talbot called Brothers, which was about Robert Kennedy investigating his brother's murder. And I want to say about David Talbot that he was the ex-editor of Salon and a fantastic author who just wrote The Devil's Chessboard, which was a bio on Alan Dulles, but really contains the JFK assassination within it. But David has just had a stroke, actually, which shocked everyone. And so on his Facebook and stuff, there's a GoFundMe and people just giving whatever support they can to it. And I encourage everyone to go there, because Talbot has done amazing work and is just a super guy. But in his work, I do think that Talbot was opening up the secret about RFK. And RFK, looking at this situation, he understood that how that deep state operated. And he understood from the beginning. He sent a message over to his Russian counterparts, who were telling him, look, we had nothing to do with this. And he said, no, I understand that my brother was felled in a domestic conspiracy. This is very important. So he understood it was an inside job. And his role, I think, is interesting. But, it's when this came out on Charlie Rose, Charlie Rose is shocked, right? He can't say anything because he has to go along with the official party line. And he can't follow up on it for real. But there it is in public, Robert Kennedy, from his son, now saying for a fact that RFK did not accept the Warren Commission or the results. I think that's very important.
It's brave, too. I mean, it's a deadly thing. I mean, it's possible that JFK Jr. was murdered.
Yes, I think it's more than possible, I think, given the circumstances, absolutely. But it's disturbing in any case. And, as far as the family goes, it's a terrible tragedy, and they've been through many. Mm-hmm. But
it's unfathomable, actually. I don't know how they...
Yes, it is. It's, their faith certainly is their major backbone.
Sure.
But that kind of tragedy, I think, is just remarkable. And, of course, that was Robert Kennedy running for election in 1968, who, when he got assassinated, and he was definitely going to be a shoo-in and beat Nixon and stop the Vietnam War. I mean, I think that's pretty obvious what was going on there. So we can see that the deep state turns the tides of history. It's, you know, there's the personal aspect where the family loses someone and we as a community lose someone. But there's this other picture, which is the deep state is moving all the time and they are changing the players on the board. So you can eliminate in 1968 two major players like MLK and RFK within a 2-month period and just don't miss a beat. Then you're just moving right on down the line with Nixon. And of course, Nixon surprised them too, because even when he got in, there were some things that he did that they didn't like, and they were like, we have to get rid of this guy. So they, you know, Peter Dale Scott identifies this period as the deep state versus the presidency, which I found fascinating. And that lasts all the way through from Kennedy to when the attempt on Ronald Reagan is made. It's 20 years of the deep state versus the presidency until they really got happy in there with Bush. And then from then on, they've been happy ever since.
Until now.
Well, this is the big problem. This is really what we're talking about. And then we go, you know, when we talk about the Trump CIA deep state thing, there's such a knee-jerk reaction because so many people on the left or in the Democratic side want to get rid of Trump, but they can't look to things like the deep state to do it. You know, this is a democratically elected president. And, you know, when we see things like the CIA trying to leak fake information or fake dossiers about Trump, we should be outraged whether we agree with Trump or not.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, I was a Democrat my whole life and I can't be anymore. And I'm not, certainly not a Republican either, but it's like, I think that this manipulation has just served to unmask the bogusness of these political parties.
Bogusness is a great, and that's very much an Alexandra kind of word. I'm going to read a couple of things. This is very important. Garrison, who was the New Orleans DA, that is the only person to have tried anyone for the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And of course, his life was celebrated in the JFK movie that Oliver Stone made, and that's where we got the JFK Records Act. So this is all very connected when we go back to Garrison. And by the way, the big bombshell with Garrison has yet to drop, even though his investigation was in the late 60s. So I'm gonna leave some of that in there, and we're going to talk about this some more. But so here he is speaking to Playboy, and this is an incredible interview. I suggest anyone go back and get it. I have read it thoroughly, and there's so much information in here about his investigation. But in this very interesting section, he talks about Gary Underhill, who was a CIA agent who felt that the CIA had assassinated Kennedy. And I'm just going to go through this and read it real quick. So this is the Playboy question. Do you lend no credence then to the charges of former CIA agent J. Garrett Underhill that there was a conspiracy within the CIA to assassinate Kennedy? And Garrison says, quote, I've become familiar with the case of Gary Underhill, and I've been able to ascertain that he was not the type of man to make wild or unsubstantiated charges. Underhill was an intelligence agent in World War II and an expert on military affairs whom the Pentagon considered one of the country's top authorities on warfare. Very interesting. He was on good personal terms with the top brass in the Defense Department and the ranking officials in the CIA. He wasn't a full-time CIA agent, but he performed special assignments for the agencies. Several days after the president's assassination, Underhill appeared at the home of friends in New Jersey, apparently badly shaken, and charged that Kennedy was killed by a small group within the CIA. He told friends he believed his own life was in danger. We can't learn any more from Underhill, I'm afraid, because shortly afterward, he was found shot to death in his Washington apartment. The coroner ruled suicide, but he had been shot behind the left ear and the pistol was found under his left side, and Underhill was right-handed, unquote. So this is very interesting because we have to remember that the deep state will also kill their own.
Oh, yeah.
This is absolutely crucial. As soon as they, you know,
they're done with them, then they're expendable.
Absolutely. And I do think that we get into, you know, always thinking of it as us versus this monolith thing. You have people inside of these agencies who object to what the covert wings of these agencies do. And actually, by exposing the deep state, you're helping those people who are inside the system fight it. And that's why in many ways, like, you know, in a way, the work that you're doing or the stuff I'm bringing forward, it's not anti-authority. It's not anti-government.
It's anti-corruption. It's anti-crime.
Yes. That's very important, though, because you can see how someone could come to a very different conclusion.
Oh, it's not. In the beginning, you know, I remember I had a subscriber who was a hardcore Marine, and he was so brainwashed that he was like, he accused me of being anti-American. And I was like, how dare you? Yes. And I never have talked to him again.
Wow. Well, see, this is ridiculous, too, because you chose America because you have dual citizenship. You could live in Brazil.
I can have a third citizenship, like be Italian.
All right. So, you know, you're showing your patriotism being here, mm-hmm. and fighting the good fight. You could be living in some sweet situation in Brazil. I do think that's important to point out, though, because that patriotism thing always rings hollow, because if you're a patriot, then you want the truth so you can set things right. And that's why the media uses this all the time. You know, they're like, oh, you know, how dare somebody raise this thing? Or, you know, and they have people that they can make fun of. Like Alex Jones, for example, they can make fun of him because he makes himself into that kind of shock jock character. But they really use that as the face of the entire group of alternative media that would ask questions. And that's a big mistake, because there are people who are a lot more serious about what they're doing. You know, and
it's not a big mistake on the part of the people who want to frame the whole space as being about Alex Jones. Alex Jones, they won't talk about the Las Vegas shooting.
Right. That's a good point, actually. And I'm not, you know, he's obviously done some good work in the past, but I think that the whole circusy thing around him is easy to portray.
And part of the clickbait culture that we were talking about.
Exactly.
You know, him, the way he carried on and cried before the election, like, they're chopping up babies. I couldn't get myself away from it. I watched every one of his broadcasts. I couldn't stop.
Yeah. And I think there was a weird moment after that when all the fake news stuff was coming out and the media got very aggressive after the election was over. And then you had Alex Jones coming out and apologizing for somebody in his staff covering.
Pizzagate.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty. How do you get a guy like that to apologize for anything? Yeah. There must have been a lot of legal pressure going on there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the Pizzagate thing was huge.
No question.
I mean, that was. It's going to stay huge until those people get put away.
Well, do we not have there a good example of the counter story and the junk conspiracy wrapped right around it? So it's hard to get at what is what.
Right. And it's a model, and it replays itself over and over and over again. And it's funny, you know, for someone who doesn't study this like on a daily basis, it just looks like a very crazy world. I spoke to my stepfather last night, and he just said, what's happened to our country? I mean, every time, it's just garbage. Nobody cares about culture. Nobody cares about art. Nobody cares about music. It's just this garbage. Mm-hmm. And it's like we're just getting tied up in knots with this disinformation and, distractions. And I don't know. I'm getting to the point maybe where I just want to focus on the stuff that is good. You know, just focus on, you know, maybe good art, good music.
Absolutely. It's very important. The culture cannot survive if it's degraded from all these different angles. Mm-hmm. And I think that's absolutely crucial. I'm glad he brought that up with you, because I think about this a lot in terms of what we need for a culture and the kind of culture that can support real reporting. You know, this is like a cycle that goes back and forth, as opposed to the cycle we have going on now, which is a cycle of disrespect between the leadership and the people on the ground, you know, and the kind of schizophrenic cycle that we have going on between the official story and the things that actually happen. Those are the things I think that really do harm to a society, because you get, you know, even the Kennedy thing. Look, even in, under these circumstances of years and years and years of manipulation by the deep state on the story, 7 out of 10 people understand the official story is bunk. What does that tell you?
It doesn't work. And then it just makes a junk culture. And, you know, yeah.
I absolutely agree. Well, let's hop into this for a minute, because one of the most important deep state witnesses that was ever eliminated was Mary Pinchot Meyer. And Mary Meyer is very fascinating because she was close to JFK. And she was also the wife of the CIA agent Cord Meyer, who was really deep in covert operations. And on his deathbed, E. Howard Hunt, who was the CIA super spy, who's friends with Caddy, who were running his interview, Hunt said in his deathbed confession that Cord Meyer Jr. worked with LBJ to set up the assassination of President Kennedy through the intelligence agencies and the people that they could work with in those agencies. So, you know, for example, the director of the CIA at that time, McCone, was just somebody who had replaced Dulles and that the Kennedys had selected. He was actually a Republican. And he didn't, you know, it's not like when we say the CIA had a role in the assassination that McCone had anything to do with it. We're talking about this wing. And I want to spotlight this wing. It's very important for us to understand who they are. When the CIA started out, there were needs like the Italian elections and other things that were going on in different countries. And there was a need for like a political activism from the outside to come in and change results so that they could help rig elections and that they could help keep the communists from winning places like Italy, for example. So they came up with this incredible kind of hardcore group that they called the Office of Policy Coordination, OPC. And OPC was that covert arm that would go in and do these types of illegal things. Now, at a certain point, Truman decided the OPC is out of control. Send the regular CIA people in to get them under control. And that wing, which has always had a problem with the regular CIA, became dominant because Dulles thought, hey, we're getting things done, like, you know, Guatemala and Iran and all these things that happened during the 50s when they were building up through the Cold War. And they thought, we're getting all these results and we're actually beating the Russians at their own game. So the OPC became that covert arm of the CIA, and they carried out so many of these things. So we're really looking at almost two different sides of an agency. And it's very important, I think, to keep that in mind, because this covert arm is the one that we're going back to again and again. So when we're looking at the Kennedy assassination, when we look at what Hunt is saying about Cord Meyer and LBJ working with elements in that CIA group, They're grabbing people from that covert wing, like Hunt, for example, who said he was a bench warmer on it, which actually Caddy doesn't believe. He thinks he was active. And there's a very interesting story. I won't go on about this part too much, but Marita Lorenz, who the CIA had set up as Castro's girlfriend to basically kill him, and she couldn't do it. She got involved in other CIA stuff, and she was very close to Frank Sturgis, who was one of the Watergate burglars with Hunt. And she said that he was very active around this period of 63 working for the CIA, and that he was driving into Dallas and wouldn't tell her why. She was driving with him, and that they stopped at a hotel, and the paymaster that came out to give him money was Hunt. So that's how far back that they were working before they got together again 10 years later in Watergate. But so that's pretty active. I wouldn't call that quite a bench warmer. But it is interesting that Hunt identified Cord Meyer. This is Cord Meyer. And I think we need to examine Meyer a little bit, because his wife was Mary Meyer, who was close to JFK. And when JFK died, they really wanted to know about the relationship with Meyer and JFK. And what happened was she became really spotlighted, and she died herself when she was on her morning jog. She got shot, and they blamed this kind of homeless guy who was really in the wrong place at the wrong time, but he didn't have the ability to do this. And about 18 months later, he was let off by the court, and it became just this kind of mystery, like who killed Mary Meyer. Now, Mary Meyer had a big influence on JFK's thinking, and they actually had an affair, and she divorced Cord Meyer. Now, it's interesting to me that Hunt identified Cord Meyer Jr., which is the guy we're just looking at, this fellow, if you can see that, as somebody who was working on this, the big event, as Hunt called it. Because, you know, here he is with Mary Meyer, and, you know, she's close to JFK, and she understands JFK's thinking. He's opening his mind. You know, JFK, during that summer of 1963, goes and speaks at American University about his vision of peace and says, we need to reexamine our the way we deal with the Soviet Union. They're people like we are, and we all have to survive and breathe the same air. And in order to get that speech in, he had to go around his own State Department. And they thought he was giving another speech, and so their mouths are dropping. And that's one of those things that's the final straw for Kennedy. But the fact that Mary Meyer, who was an artist and really a socialite in D.C. and really, you know, had this kind of incredible impression on everyone she met as this very intellectual, very politically motivated. She was close to Timothy Leary, actually, who was a pioneer of, you know, using LSD for higher consciousness and things like that. And we know that the CIA used it for very different reasons. But this is very fascinating to me because that case, there's a fantastic book that we can't go into all the details, but it's Mary's Mosaic by Peter Janney. And Janney's dad was involved in the assassination of Mary Meyer. But interestingly enough, her sister was married to Ben Bradley, who was the editor of the Washington Post. And when she was killed, Ben Bradley, and you know, the Washington Post is pretty much a CIA tie-in, even now with Bezos buying it, there's that relationship. But one of the things that I found very interesting about this whole thing that rolled out between Meyer and Ben Bradley is when Ben Bradley gets there with her sister, gets to her house, they're looking for her diary because they want to know what's going on, basically. And she had said to the sister she kept a diary of all these things and the things that she was looking into around Kennedy and all the rest. And when they get there, James Jesus Angleton, who is the head of counterintelligence at the CIA, is there already, and he's walking out with her stuff, basically. So they knew right away that something odd was going on there. And you know, her case was completely unsolved. Nobody ever got to the bottom of it. They let the guy who they accused of go, and that was it. So Mary Meyer is a very important figure when we talk about these deep state witnesses who get bumped off, because like Bruce Pitzer, or, you know, like the person that Garrison was talking about, Gary Moore, I think when you get into it, or Gary Underhill Moore, these are people who have some piece of the puzzle, and they're just dangerous enough. And then they decide we can't have them hanging around. Now, one guy that I spotlighted in the Agent Oswald documentary was Roger Craig, who was the first cop on the scene and of the assassination. And the rifle that they found was a Mauser and wasn't a Mannlicher or Carcano. And he went on the record with that. And eventually they fired him from the guy he found it with, actually, was who owned a sporting goods store. And they both looked at it and said, oh, hey, look, it says Mauser. You know, it's a Mauser. So it wasn't a Carcano. That wasn't the rifle that they found on the sixth floor. And Craig gave these interviews and told the truth and all that. So the police got rid of him. And then eventually he was found in this way, kind of like Gary Webb, where he has, you know, his suicide wound was to his chest with a rifle. Let's think about that. You know, it's not the kind of
thing. It really would take.
Yeah. So that term suicided, I think, you know, is appropriate because it's this verb. It's something that they use. And but I think in the case of Meyer, for example, and it's very unusual, the connection with Cord Meyer coming up in this conversation. I mean, who even knew about Cord Meyer? So the fact that Hunt raised his profile by mentioning him and his wife was killed just a few months after the assassination back there. It's always made that interesting. And so more information is available on that in the Mary's Mosaic book. I highly encourage everyone to look into that because that is a classic example of getting rid of a very key witness And these are really deep state eliminations like we've been talking about.
Right, which persist to the present day, and it's just part of our political culture. And it's not really, it's only acknowledged in the pop culture, not really in the official culture. That's what's
right. Yeah, it's a great point. Well, you might see a movie that would get into these types of things, right?
Pop culture, but
as long as you can get it in there. Mm-hmm. But I think it is important to understand how the politics part works. For example, you know, the mafia being so involved with the political scene heavily. I mean, the mafia has been really pushed around a lot now. They've certainly been, they've had their problems. But I think the mafia played a role in this election also, because the mafia is certainly, there's a couple of things I think we can say there is certainly there's a kind of patriotic streak that the mafia has.
Yeah.
And but the other thing is that they probably didn't like the Obamacare premiums because they took everybody's money for gambling, who was, you know, so their casinos and all the rest of it, all those things start to go down when they're paying this like $2,000 or $3,000 extra a year that would be going.
Right. Well, in just general, I mean, it is very right wing, you know, so they don't like any of this pinko stuff.
Yes. I do think that Trump has those kinds of connections because of Roy Cohn, who was his political mentor. And Cohn is such an organized crime figure, in a sense, because, I mean, he's been in there since the McCarthy hearings in the 50s.
Well, and just Trump having been involved in the construction business in Manhattan.
Yeah.
He had to be involved with the mob, and owning casinos in Jersey had to be involved with the mob. So he's all mobbed up.
I think so. I think so. You know, it's interesting too, because when we think about Trump, it's not that it's some scandal that he's involved, you know, he was involved with the mob or something, because all of these politicians on some level have been.
You can't get away. I don't know what's really happening now, but having been in the film business in New York City, the unions were all mobbed up. I mean, you just, everyone was interfacing with the mob constantly. There was no escape. The Teamsters, everything was controlled by the mob. You couldn't get away from it.
No question.
So when I say that he's mobbed up, it's just he had no choice. I think if he had a choice, he wouldn't be dealing with them, obviously, but there was no getting away from them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you go all the way back to Kennedy and Nixon, they also were dealing with Marcello and all those other people. That's just the way that the game was played. And of course, Kennedy's dad was very tight with the mafia. We know that. That's an easy one. So it is interesting, though. We must understand politics from a real point of view, because when we look at things like organized crime, when we look at things like these tactics that they use, like the Seth Rich case, for example, that you're talking about, and this is somebody who was leaking possibly to WikiLeaks, which is where the tension was coming from. And then we look at somebody like Assange, who we know they've put intense, incredible pressure, you know, putting this guy holed up for 6 years in an embassy on a phony sex charge. You know, so these are the forces that are working there. And it's not that I'm saying any particular political figure is corrupt because they're working. It's just that we have to understand the pressures and the situation that they're in so we can see through them to their concerns and to who's holding the puppet strings. The deep state part is very interesting because the deep state had a major split in the 2016 election. I don't think there's any question about it. And that thin part, the America First part, which Peter Dale Scott identifies as the National Association of Manufacturers, for example, this element decided to support Trump and it split from the National Security Expansion of Empire group. That's a very important thing that happened.
And well, that would be the unions, right?
Yes.
So that's traditionally left wing, but not this time.
Well, look at Pennsylvania. That is a union state, and it went for Trump.
Well, so, and it's also a very swing state, you know. But so you can see how, yeah, it's very interesting.
Reagan had them. Reagan had Pennsylvania and Michigan. Mm-hmm. All those states are really states that Trump won back this time. Why did that happen? I mean, it's really the split occurred that wasn't there before. And the Democrats had that stuff sewn up since the Clinton days, for sure. But that's all changed now.
Right. And then the Democrats had formerly been the racist party.
Yes, right, yeah. Well, it's the Republicans who freed the slaves, right? That's Abraham Lincoln. So it is fascinating.
Right. Well, the Southern Democrats were the ones who, you know, basically the Ku Klux Klan were Democrats. Mm-hmm. And the Southern Democrats were the ones who wanted to keep segregation going.
Yes.
And it was Reagan was the one who converted those people. They all became Republican because of Reagan. Right. Reagan Democrats.
They call them Blue Dog Democrats.
Yeah.
It is fascinating. Our final deep state witness elimination case for tonight. There's so many. And this one is Dorothy Kilgallen. Dorothy Kilgallen's a fascinating figure. You know, she
was a very, very fascinating to be that prominent and that successful as a comedian, political writer and things as far back as she was incredibly impressive.
She was really deep in there. She's close friends with Marilyn Monroe, and she is one of the first journalists to cover the Roswell incident and the whole thing about it. And she was doing it in the late 50s. This is somebody who's very advanced and very much looking for the real story. Kilgallen got it in her head that there was something wrong with the JFK assassination, and if that she could get to Jack Ruby, she could figure it all out. So she did. She arranged this plan, and she's the only journalist to ever interview Ruby by himself, which I think is very interesting. And her point of view, according to friends, is that the whole thing, of course, was very different than it was portrayed. But she was building up a lot of information. And this is a woman who was like on the popular shows of the day, like What's My Line and things like that. Just this incredible kind of chatty character who was really in the know. And so she's found in her hotel room and, you know, apparently some kind of a drug overdose with, you know, alcohol and drugs going on. But there was a weird thing with it where she's reading this book in bed and her husband's the first one who figures out something weird like that. He says, look, her glasses are over here on the nightstand and she's reading a book. You know, it's like there was so many times.
Yeah.
So oddly enough, I mean, there were a number of things around it, but it was such an unusual case that somebody kept, because it was unsolved, that they kept part of the autopsy results for years and then went back and double checked it. And basically she'd been, you know, they'd given her these drugs. They'd given her this overdose because she'd gotten very close to the case and all her materials had disappeared. Well, we've seen this over and over again, and it is, you know, the kind of deep state operation that is classically identified in the JFK assassination. But these people and these journalists leave a track record, I think, when we look at them. And people like Mary Meyer, for example, she was really, even with working in her relationship with Kennedy to try to get him to see things differently and try to see he was manipulated. So there are these characters there who are unspoken heroes in history who really influence things a lot. And they became dangerous one reason or another to the deep state. And certainly Kilgallen was one of them. And for them to take out somebody who was so prominent, like a television person, somebody that everyone knew, was really a big signal to anyone else who wanted to come forward on that to just quiet down. Now, what's fascinating is when people think about the JFK witness elimination program, they go from the Warren Commission period, but every time it gets raised, there's another wave of people get bumped off. So in the Church Committee, there's a series of deaths. The House Assassination Committee, there's a series of deaths. And then in the 90s with the ARRB, the JFK Records Act, there's another series of deaths around it. So it's working to keep that secret. And, you know, we've tied it all the way around. I guess the message here is that when we look at these people who come forward and are doing this kind of work, that they really do need our support and that we need to take a larger view around, you know, what constitutes the deep state and why they would take these types of actions. But you've brought it up to date all the way in the Las Vegas case. And when we see these strange things happening from people who are telling a different story than the official narrative, there's a chasm there. And it's very volatile. It's like a volcano. And it's hazardous. So if you want to look on the side of the alien story or the UFO story, somebody looking deep into that. Of course, there's a remarkable story about Mac Tunnies, who was going pretty deep in his research, I would say. And he came up with this whole crypto humanoid thing and died at 34 under very unusual circumstances. So when we have these people that are investigating these deep state aspects, it's very important, I think, that they get our support. You go into the UFO side and you'll go all the way back to people like Morris Jessup, you know, who supposedly committed suicide on a roadside by, you know,
carbon monoxide.
Yes, carbon monoxide. So, you know, this thing goes back. Anytime we get close to those secrets, whether we're talking about deep state eliminations, the UFO secrecy, whatever it happens to be, we have to understand these things better. And it doesn't help us in independent media to be distracted by junk conspiracy, because we do a lot better when we have facts on the ground and we can understand these patterns. We get a true journalism, and you know, that's the kind of thing I think that people can really tune into and not get confused by. So I started the day off with McCain's leg brace, and I'll use it as an example, because that's the kind of stupid stuff that we just don't need to engage in around the alternative media. We need better standards, and to get to the truth, you know, we run the kind of things like the stories that you run and the types of investigations that we're doing. And that's where I think we need to go.
Right. Did you see the LBJ thing on weather manipulation, and he who controls the weather controls the world? He controls the world! Like he did a Hitler thing.
Tell us all about it.
Well, that's it. It's just a 41-second clip that Harold Schaaf found on the Texas archive of the Moving Image. It's just a 41-second beat from an address he was giving at the University of Western Texas in 1962. And yeah, it's funny, but the people who responded, I mean, the response was interesting that I got from that, from people. One guy said, "What a pompous ass." But it's like, it's worse than pompous. He was a diabolical, I mean, it's straight out of, you know, the Great Dictator or something. You know, it was almost a comedy routine. It's like, was that LBJ saying we could control the world?
Well, and he tried, and he tried. Well, it's interesting, actually, because he's talking about weather modification there in 1962. We know in 1998, the Secretary of Defense under Clinton, William Cohen, accidentally mentioned, he said, well, we can't let our weather modification weapons get in the hands of terrorists. We have to prevent that from happening. And there was a big, like, what is he talking about? So certainly these are the types of things that we have and that do exist. And this is important too, because, you know, it's like, it's a simple phrase, but tell the people, we do need to understand these things. It's not the kind of thing that the regular citizens can be left in the dark about. But I am really glad you found that clip, because I think it's fascinating. And I suggest everyone go there to forbiddenknowledgetv.net and check it out. I'm going to see if we have time here for at least a few questions, but I do want to mention to everybody that the HBO clip, 5 minutes of the HBO segment, is available at darkjournalist.com, and you can go there and watch it to get a feel for the report that we did with HBO Vice News, which I think they did a really good job on this. So I highly recommend people check it out. And I will have a very important announcement again next week. So there's more big announcements coming, folks. So this is a very exciting period of time that we're in here. And you can guess, if I have this announcement coming up, that Alexandra's going to be involved too.
Except I don't know what the announcement is.
Well, that's the whole nature of the thing, isn't it? Okay, so let's see. I'm going to see if we have... Now, Groovy Bean is out there. That's Yvonne Palermo. And she's running the moderator chat. So hello, Groovy Bean, and thank you for taking care of business out there. And thank you to everyone in chat for showing up for this. So let's see what we have for questions. Okay. We'll take a look at those. But how do you think, by the way, Alexandra, how are we doing 54 years out on the Kennedy assassination? Do you think that the files release kind of reignited people's memory about this or got them interested in the first place?
I think it did because it happened just a couple of weeks after Las Vegas, and people began seeing the direct parallels to both cases, this whole idea of a lone nut doing it and sort of impossible scenarios being forwarded by officialdom that just were impossible to buy, to accept by anyone. And, you know, just that this incredible breakdown of trust between the public and the deep state, I guess is what you'd have to call it, by officialdom. I think people are, my favorite thing was when people started calling Stephen Paddock Lee Harvey Paddock.
Oh.
It was perfect. I mean,
that really hits it where it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there is something fascinating about this because we're in this period of time where we can look back 54 years and we never got the official story then. And you can say, well, they had concerns, the Cold War, whatever. People try to talk their way around why they didn't get the straight story then. But then you look at the fact that when these records were supposed to come out on October 26, 2017, they didn't come out. They gave us less than 20% of the records. And like I said, the Jim Garrison records are completely scrubbed. So, you know, we're not getting the truth 54 years later. It's not like it was some isolated incident from some Cold War government.
Oh, it's pretty much the inauguration of the terror dome that we're living in today.
It is terror dome. It is. And this is the nature of the problem, I think. Now, that kind of transparency is the thing, you know, that we're talking about is what you're going to need. Can you imagine getting into a serious UFO event, you know, like we had with the Phoenix Lights, with crafts sitting over a city? I mean, the culture, you know, is so distracted. How would we even be ready for something like that? So I think it is important to get those kinds of truths out there so people can start to deal with it. Because, I mean, I think that's the type of environment that we're in. We could have kind of, I'd never use the word disclosure, but we could have some kind of accident, you know, accidental truth rising to the surface on this.
Indeed. And it's interesting how we haven't really had a lot of UFO stuff lately.
It's true. It's true. Well, yeah, not reported.
Not publicized. Or not, I guess, you know, I think that the Phoenix Lights thing was just, they couldn't not report on it because it was, I think it was ongoing for weeks, right? And millions of people saw it.
Well, what I think, and this is a little known story around the Phoenix Lights, there's two very important things to point out there. One is that everyone was out there looking for a comet that night. And the people who've related the story to me that I've talked to about it tell me about a gigantic craft that blocked out half of the sky.
I mean, wow.
Large. Now, one of the interesting things is the governor of the state, Fife Symington, he originally ridiculed it, as we know. But then later he came out and became a good guy and disclosed and said, you know what, this is what happened. I saw it. I was in the Air Force. I've never seen anything like it. And he really owned up to his mistake there in those press conferences. But I will say this, a year after the Phoenix Lights, he came into controversy and they tried to take him out of the governorship for taking bribes. And he was looking at long prison sentences and stuff. I think there was something weird about the Phoenix Lights that had a ripple around it in terms of the political situation there as well, because that's a strange detail that nobody ever brings up about him. And I found it odd, let's put it that way. And I found that after he got into that trouble, that's when he came out and he was like, you know what? I did see that UFO and it was stunning and it is like nothing else.
There's a crazy story about, what's his name? Goldie Hawn's, not husband, but de facto husband. He was a pilot. He was flying in to Phoenix that night, and I think he was one of the first people to report it as a private pilot.
Right, right.
What's his name? Kurt Russell.
Yes, that's absolutely interesting, too. So unusual. Well, the Phoenix Lights has very unusual aspects around it. One, like I was just saying, the comet part. Two, just sitting over a major city like that, seems like whoever's behind those controls wants this to get out. And I think that's important, because if somebody said, well, it's a military craft, let's use it as an exercise, it doesn't quite add up, because that's the kind of thing I think they would do more under wraps. I don't think they want to reveal their major hardware in that way. So, you know, it's very important, I think, when we look at this, to say it's one of the best opportunities that we have of seeing this was probably an off-world craft, an off-world situation that was going on. And I know from Linda Moulton Howe's work that some of the people that she talked to said that when you know, the DOD was trying to check it out, it actually fried one of their satellites.
Wow. Well, I found the story because he just came out about this recently. He was on a press junket for a movie maybe last year, I think. And it was on a British daytime talk show. And he says he was piloting into Phoenix, and there were six flying unidentified objects dead ahead. He verified this and reported it prior to landing and then taking off back to Los Angeles. He and his passenger never thought or talked about it ever again. He just reported it. But in his case, it was six objects. And then this is what's so weird is that it's weird. He reported it and that was the end of it. He went home. And then just a few years ago, he was watching television with Goldie. And he walked into the room and overheard a narrator. It was like, I think, a documentary on the Phoenix lights. And the narrator said something about a civil aviator having reported it. And then he realized that civil aviator was him.
Wow. That's
incredible. I love these kinds of stories when it's back around finally, you know.
It is weird when it involves a celebrity too. It's like, what on earth is going on there?
I would never have even remembered it if it hadn't been, you know, when reports of UFO, he wasn't paying attention, you know, checking for any of that. He just happened to be, you know, he saw something weird, he reported it, he landed, he went home.
Wow. That's incredible. That's absolutely amazing. I'm glad you brought that one up. We have a couple of questions here. I'm going to read them to you. I'm going to give you this one because I think this is right up your alley. It says, it's from Lee, and it's, do y'all think this is all a big psyop going back to the MKUltra and COINTELPRO and Monarch programming re the Vegas shooting?
That the Vegas shooting, because that is, people are saying that the whole thing is fake. It's just a big false flag with crisis actors. I don't think that that's what's going on.
No, definitely not.
And was Stephen Paddock a brainwashed person? From the stuff that I've seen, I don't think Stephen Paddock acted alone or maybe even at all in this shooting. And that the guns in his room might have been a separate thing. Looks like more of a Fast and Furious gone wrong, and then maybe some of the people who were involved in that deal went out and were all over the place in at least nine different hotel lobbies or exteriors of the lobby shooting guns off. It sounds to me like it was a major. There was a terrorist attack, and but what's interesting is that the people who are filing a lawsuit against. And this is very important. People who are filing a class action lawsuit against MGM are citing the official evidence in their lawsuit.
Mm.
They're not, you know, I guess, well, it's only about MGM. Well, actually, they own half of the hotels or more on the Strip. When you really look, all of those hotels are MGM. It's not just Mandalay Bay.
Wow.
Seven of them are MGM owned.
Well, we have, there's a lot of weird things around that because Catherine Austin Fitz was mentioning in our last interview, she talked about this a little bit and she was talking about Steve Wynn and
how. I have a weird Steve Wynn story. Go ahead.
No, I want to hear that actually.
Well, this was really weird. You know, in the week following the shooting, he was live on one of the mainstream, I'm forgetting which station, but, which network. But he was saying, this was very strange, because at that point, if you recall, the only photograph that had ever been shown of Stephen Paddock, and there really are only three, or four at the most, was just that one where he had his eyes shut and he was holding what looks like a shot of tequila in his hand, and his eyes were closed. He was like, ugh! You know, it's a ridiculous picture. This guy with his eyes closed with a shot glass. Absolutely ridiculous. And so, you know, everyone, the first thing everyone's thinking is that this guy was a raging drunk, right?
Right.
And so what Steve Wynn said is, oh, we knew him. He was a very, what did he say? He was like a very, something to the effect of that he was very high functioning. He was a high roller. He got a lot of freebies from us. You know, he would wine and dine his family with, you know, surf and turf dinners and things. But one thing I will say that was, that all the workers that I've spoken to and myself that I've observed with Stephen Paddock is that he and his girlfriend never drank alcohol, ever.
Interesting.
And so I just, you know, it was jaw-dropping, a jaw-dropping statement. It almost was like, you know, the only photograph that anyone had seen was of him with a shot of tequila.
So weird.
Yeah.
Well, we want to think of him as just this kook, right? This alcoholic kook who just had to do this. But that's part of building an image, really, too.
Right.
Into this. Well,
so it almost seemed like it was on purpose on the part of Steve Wynn to try to tear down that, you know, character construction that was being done. He was saying no. He was a very effective guy. He was an excellent gambler and. He took advantage, you know, he was really good at taking advantage of us. We gave him lots of very expensive, you know, steak and seafood dinners for his family. You know, that's what he said.
Right. Well, I think it is very strange. And there's an extra context around it. Now, I have to mention this part just because I'm curious, and I know that all the facts aren't in on this, but what about this involvement of this Saudi guy?
Right. Well, he is, this was Al-Walid bin Talal, who is still being held captive by the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia as we speak. The top four floors of the Mandalay Bay building are the Four Seasons Hotel, of which bin Talal is a major owner, like, you know, at least a third or a large stakeholder in the Four Seasons Hotel chain is this Prince Al-Walid bin Talal. Some people, and there was one guy, Gio Rios, whose testimony I ran, and sort of that was a story that I haphazardly broke. I just happened to be on Facebook to post, you know, make a post and then quickly leave, but that somebody who has been a reader of mine for 20 years now, he said, hey, have you seen this? And it was a Facebook video. And I thought, wow, this was a kid named Gio Rios who was describing a blow by blow of the events of that night. You know, eyewitness account of what happened from the front row of the concert and getting shot at and people falling on top of him and things like this for hours and shots coming from all kinds of directions and in the Tropicana Hotel where he hid and just an amazing eyewitness account. Which really sounds like a terrorist attack.
Wow.
And what this kid described when he was in the Tropicana in a hallway where there was a dead body, a person had expired right there, was a like a brown-skinned man who he described as looking like he was Armenian with a suitcase that looked like it had a gun in it, like one that you would assemble. And, but that, you know, and that there were shots fired. He was going to this room where they were in the casino at the Tropicana where there were shots fired shortly after. And that, and he said he really got the feeling that this guy was involved with, that he could easily have been killed by this guy.
Wow.
And,
holy mackerel.
Right. So, yeah, and this is what this kid said. This was a terrorist attack and they're still out there. They didn't get them. And that's what's totally being covered up.
Well, it would be quite an incident because, of course, we're really partnered up with Saudi Arabia right now.
Right, and it just all seems like it's related. Now, I don't know. Like Talal, you know, he's one of the owners of Twitter and Citigroup, and he's a totally liberal guy. You know, and which the prince purports to be. He's also one of the richest human beings on the planet, bin Talal. So, But he's a feminist. He hired a woman to be his pilot in a country where women aren't allowed to drive cars. You know, he trained and sort of fostered this person to make that point, you know?
That is
fascinating. So it's not like he's a hardliner or anything, you know, like he's a Wahhabist or anything like that.
I mean, there was that sense of an arms deal that went wrong there.
Yeah, there was a really, probably the best, the most sensical explanation came from somebody who posted to Reddit that's what it was. It was an arms deal gone bad. That's the explanation that makes the most sense.
You know, I think you really, I'm looking forward to more reporting on that because I think that you're really keying in on an interesting area there. And, you know, I don't think it's anything conclusive about this guy's witness testimony, but we're getting something from that, you know, and I wonder if there aren't other people who would corroborate that.
Well, there are, but they're all in different hotels and they are, you know, I have one from Planet Hollywood, another one who was at the Bellagio, and these are all people who made videos and who, you know, one, the Bellagio woman said, I don't care about it, conspiracy theory. This isn't about that. I'm disappointed with the hotels for lying to us.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's a great point, right? It's more than just the media. It's the actual corporate structure there.
And this is a company town.
They need to play along with it. There's no question about it. There's way more than meets the eye at this point. We did get a question here about, I don't know how to say that. It looks like 6-7. And what do you think about Oswald's lover? Is she legit? And you must be speaking about Judith Barry Baker. And Judith Baker is actually in my documentary, Agent Oswald. I interviewed her there about David Ferry.
She sounds legit to me.
Yeah, I've always felt that the things that she was bringing forward about her time in New Orleans being around Oswald, we know that they both worked in the Wiley Coffee Company, but I do think it's interesting, you know, and it's not to say, this is what's so interesting about the Kennedy case, because people like Judith Baker, or there are other people around it, when they come in, there's varying levels of legitimacy, you know, like James Files, for example. When that comes up, I don't believe anything about the James Files story, except that he was one of these guys that the mafia could hire here or there. And I don't believe he was the shooter on the grassy knoll or bit the bullet or anything like that. But you can see this is a classic thing, because when we look into other areas like the secret space program or the UFO story, there are these people who come in and they have their version of a story. So when you use the Kennedy case as a template, you start to understand how to separate the disinformation from the real facts, from people who are just mistaken or whatever it happens to be. But you get a better picture because, you know, you look at something like the Kennedy assassination, you'll see that the people who believe in this mafia theory don't agree and don't talk to the people who have the CIA aspects down. Or there are other people who think that, you know, it was all in relation to something completely different, you know? So those levels of people won't talk to each other. And then when I bring forward someone like Caddy, who says it's about the UFO factor, the JFK assassination community, they missed all those details about Bobby Inman that I've done on these shows, or Douglas Caddy, or what Hunt said to, you know, they far more prefer what Hunt said about LBJ, for example. But it is interesting when you look at these splintering of stories and how we understand things, it's natural that people would have different opinions, but it's very important, just like with 9/11, you know, there are people who are on the architects and engineers side and they believe in the thermite story about it. And when they get into Judy Wood stuff, she's so hostily, you know, they just attack her because her story is very advanced in a lot of ways because it talks about energy weapons and it's ahead of its time. And these aspects just savage each other, but that's not a way to come to any kind of legitimate answers about these types of things. And I think that the Kennedy assassination, when we have people who come forward, like St. John Hunt, who is Hunt's son, with this deathbed confession, and I'm not saying that everything in there, which answers another question, which is I don't believe everything that Hunt said in his deathbed confession because he's a CIA propaganda artist and he needs to leave certain things out, like calling himself a bench warmer instead of an active participant. But I think there's enough there to give us really a good insight. And his insight was about Kordmire. Nobody had really focused on Kordmire before. I think that's very interesting. And I think the LBJ aspect, working with elements in the CIA, is important and interesting. But I think he told way more of a whopper to Douglas Caddy about the alien presence, and that that is not something that's in the deathbed confession, although he did say it outside of Yenching Palace to Douglas Caddy in Washington, D.C. in 1975 before he went off to prison. So those were great questions. We are now that we're particularly have to rush here because our moderator is going off to, she's got an interview. So we're wrapping it up. And thank you, Groovy Bean. Those were great questions. And thank you for everyone who was asking the questions and being with us tonight. Alexandra, outstanding information.
Thank you for having me. It's always great. Let's do it again.
Absolutely. And how did you feel about your cameo in the HBO special, by the way?
Oh, it was fine. I usually I'm horrified, but by the way I look and stuff. I hate being on camera.
You gotta be kidding.
But it was okay.
You did great. You were fantastic in that. And you know, I really recommend everybody go to the darkjournalist.com website. It's actually darkjournalist.com. And both my the HBO special clips are there, and also the Coast to Coast AM interview that I had with Linda Moulton Howe on the JFK assassination and the Jim Garrison investigation of the aerospace wing are both there. And also at earthfiles.com, there's a 4-part report that I did with Douglas Caddy and Linda Moulton Howe that's there that goes into George Janitis, who we started these JFK file stories off with. And it goes into the Garrison investigation and how Alan Dulles, who Linda Moulton Howe has tracked very closely, was MJ1 in MJ12. So he was certainly highly motivated when Kennedy fired him to find a way to remove that obstacle, and would have been particularly sensitive about sharing the UFO file with the Russians. That was just something they weren't going to let Kennedy do for a variety of reasons, the least of which isn't the fact that they wanted to keep that technology and give it to certain segments of this kind of elite corporate interface with the government and hold that stuff as really, you know, Kennedy is all about freedom. He's really about sharing this. He wants to do a joint moon mission with the Soviets. This is a very different approach to history instead of the Cold War and Vietnam and really withholding this advanced science and withholding this advanced technology even to this day. So I think those are truths that need to come out, and shows like this are where we're going to do it. So I appreciate it, everyone. Thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for your support on the HBO Vice News special. And the Caddy interview is coming up this week. I think it's explosive. Please stay tuned for that. And please go to forbiddenknowledgetv.net, where you're going to find Alexandra's work as well.
Thank you.
Okay, and we'll talk soon. Bye, everybody.
Night.
One of these days, I'm going to learn how to easily shut this off, but I'm going to take the mouse from the floor here and see how this works. So thank you. And by the way, everyone, while I'm signing off here, you can sign up for the newsletter. It's free, and it lets you know when the latest shows are up there, and you get some of those shows right in your inbox. So do it. Thank you, Yvonne, and have a great interview. I know you're going off tonight. And thank you, everyone, over there in chat. I do read them all, and I do appreciate the questions and the comments. If we don't get to all of them, sometimes I bring them up in the next show also. So thank you very much, and we'll talk soon.
Bye.